This is Mame Warren. Today is the October 29th, 1996. I'm at Lookout Mountain, Tennessee with Ann Farrer Willett. And you go back a long way with Washington and Lee.
Yep. 1952, I think, 51.
All right, my first question to you is I just want to get myself straight. You went to Randolph-Macon. You grew up in Lynchburg and went to Randolph-Macon. Were you and Jim dating when you were in college?
No. I would go to W&L with boys. I had one good friend in particular and met Jim at the Delt House. And I suppose it was in 1949, and we dated all during that spring. He was class of 49, which of course was the bicentennial year, is that right? And he graduated in 49 and then went to Columbia to graduate school, but we continued to see each other until we married in November of 1950. And so it was, so my life has really been Washington and Lee, starting really then.
So you did have the experience as a college girl over to Washington.
Oh, yeah.
I want to hear that, because I haven't talked to that many women from that time period. And the bicentennial year, must have been really special.
Well, it was, except that, you know, you're such dingbats when you're that age, and all you're really thinking about is all the fun and what we're going to do.
Well, that's what I want to hear.
But I do still have the stamp. You know, Jim wrote me. His father was an alumnus, and I suppose our romance thrived because there was still, my mother remembered his father, for example, back in her days of going to parties at Washington and Lee, and one or two of her friends had known him, and they were particularly interested in this nice Farrer boy who was Jed Farrer's. His father was known as J.I.D. Jed. You know, and how that would be. They said, well, can you believe this is Jed Farrer's son coming to Lynchburg to see Ann Scott? So it was sort of only in the South kind of thing. Anyway, Jim was called back in the Marine Corps. That was the result of, I don't think I was there, a big party in front of the Delt House, everybody sitting out in the yard, and all these boys were vets, and he'd been in the Pacific. He had finished CHOAT and matriculated at Yale, knowing that he would turn 18 that summer and go straight in the Marine Corps. But Washington Lee being his father's college, he came back to W&L rather than to go on to Yale. And Frank Gillum was an old friend of his father's and had always thought a lot of Jim during his as a student. And so when he rushed out and re-enlisted, as a bunch of them did, in the Marine Corps Reserve. I'm told they'd all been drinking beer that afternoon and thought it'd be a good idea to go across the street to the post office, and this sudden burst of patriotism. And of course the recruiter said, oh, you'll never be called back. I mean, this is just So Jim was the only one in the crowd who was a sergeant. All the rest of them had their commissions. So he signed up, and of course along came the Korean War, and he was called back in as a sergeant. So after that year of servitude and great frustration for him, because he had expected to be at CHOAT teaching by that time, he was out, and there was a telegram from Frank Gillum saying, I would like you to, something to the effect of, call me, need help, you know, in those days, kind of message from Western Union. So he came to help Frank Gillum out for a few months, and he stayed 42 years or whatever it was.
That's the Washington and Lee way.
And so, yeah, so our earliest memories of W&L, at least mine, had to do with going over the mountain. And it was spring, and of course, crew was a big sport then. and going over to the James River, Glasgow, to watch the boys row and the competition. And it was a lovely, in retrospect, I realized how, what a lovely, carefree, laid-back time, and how much fun we had, because it was very intimate, and probably still is. But I mean, you know, all the Fidels, and one prominent feature of those times, the closeness, the Jewish fraternities. You know, there were two Jewish houses.
Tell me about that.
And our most intimate friends, several of them forever, were in the Jewish fraternities, ZBT and Pi, I can't think of what it was, the other one, it's Phi, Peeps, we call them, Phi Epsilon Pi, the Peeps, and just great friends, and we had a very strong, outstanding young men were part of the Jewish student group. And I don't think that's, of course, obviously that's sort of thing is past, and we don't have that anymore. But I think we were enriched by a Jewish constituency at that time. Frank Gillam had a lot to do with that. He had a lot of ties, a lot of people who would recommend it. It's just, I feel almost hesitant to talk about it. It sounds so sort of prejudice to talk, maybe that's not the word, but anyway, that was the situation. There were two strong Jewish fraternities, very fine boys, and I think a lot of those who are now obviously grown middle-aged men and many gone felt that Washington and Lee had sort of failed them, I think, in that this tradition. They were distinguished families. One comes to mind because they're Lynchburg families, the Shule family. All the Shule boys went to W&L and remain our pride and joy. I mean, the younger ones are still coming. And, mm-hmm. and so we've lost some of that. That
just occurs to me. Why do you think that's happened?
Well, I think it's part of the times. There's more, much more integration of the separation of Jewish boys, just students, just wouldn't happen today. It's all mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you mean that there are still Jewish students there, but they're not staying in their own fraternities? Or mm-hmm. do you mean that there aren't Jewish students
there?
There
are not as many Jewish students. I don't think we make an effort. I think the Jewish students, now I'm talking about back now in the 40s, Southern, well, you go back to Stephen Birmingham and read about the Jewish people. And in the South, you know, the financial houses that are now in New York, many of them were founded, you know, in Alabama, down in Mobile. We were very strong in New Orleans, very distinguished Jewish families from the South sent their sons to Washington and Lee. And I never thought about it at the time as being tolerant. It just wasn't. We were just all the same and great friends, and there wasn't any thought about, at least to me, nor to Jim, these were our best friends. And they were distinguished citizens in all their community.
Mm-hmm.
I think it must have had something to do with the Southern tradition. But then there were doctors and, well, you know, the distinguished professional men. They went from Washington Lee into medicine, mm-hmm. into law, and were outstanding. And I think now maybe Jewish students would not feel and don't choose to come to Washington Lee in the first place. There's no synagogue, there's no life for them, and they probably prefer to be in an urban area where there is more Jewish life.
Mm-hmm.
But there was that strong tradition years ago.
When do you think that changed?
Well, that's, I've forgotten the date. You know, the peep house was there where, we had house mothers too, and the house mothers loved I recall how the Jewish boys felt. They were so lovely to their house mothers. It was a gentle way of life. I just don't think that tradition, I think the changes in the South, I suppose, and the population, I don't know, it just seems to me that it sort of went in more Jewish. I'm about to say something that I don't have any idea whether it's true or not, to say that it's more Jews living in urban areas and choose large universities. So, but I don't even know the numbers of uh-huh. Jewish students now at Washington. Uh-huh. But I dare say that it's gotten smaller uh-huh. and smaller and smaller over uh-huh. the years. And again, I come back in my own mind to Frank Gillum was thought to, and it's true, he almost hand-picked. He had friends who would say, this is a really fine boy. And he would be much more interested in accepting that boy than a Jewish boy whom he didn't know. Again, I'm feeling very badly talking about this because I think it makes Washington Lee sound as if it were prejudiced or very picky. But back in the 30s and 40s, you could be. It was a very family, you know, so-and-so get on the phone and call, say, Frank, this is a fine boy coming. I want you to take a heart. I look at him and he'd be just right for WNL. There was much more of that than there is now, obviously. Mm-hmm. Those times have gone.
Well, you know, that was one of the things that we've alluded to a couple of times in our conversation. It's like there's a profile for a Washington and Lee student, that they're a certain kind of person goes to Washington and Lee and is successful at Washington and Lee.
Well,
can you describe, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth,
no,
but would you
I
go along with that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that we are now a national constituency. That's easy to understand at a time when we were fairly regional. We, to use a term, we owned, as it were, we owned New Orleans or Baltimore. By that I mean we were strong in certain cities. And of course I think that young people coming along now, girls, but at that time, the earlier, just men, students came along and admired people in their community who were outstanding and wanted to emulate them. They were drawn to a place he went to. There was a lot of family. For example, I did a lot of research once on the, I'll think of it in a minute, the family I wanted to specify, the Likes family. And if you really go through the records, I think at that time, this would have been about 5 years ago, more members of the Likes family than any other family had over the years come to Washington Lee, and now the girls have made such outstanding records. Joe Likes, for example, was a contemporary of my father-in-law, a class of something like 14 or whatever it was, and on the board for years and years. And his sons came, and their sons came, and now the granddaughters are coming, you know. So there's some families, and that happened to be, the Likes were New Orleans at the time, but now Jacksonville, you know, Tampa family, the interests have spread and grown and gone. So there was a lot of that, which kind of maybe, as you say, the profile of the Washington and Lee man. Now, person with women. So there were always, this leadership has a lot to do with it, don't you think? And we take such pride. I try to explain to people all the time that Washington and Lee, it's to me, it's I can almost get very emotional about it. The outstanding pre-professional education which has turned out lawyers, teachers, the professions. And that's what we do best. We can't do everything, but we do that, and we do that best. And that's always been our strength. And don't you think that has attracted the kind of young people who seek to be lawyers or doctors or aspire to that? And here's a place that does it and does it so well. And of course, that was Lee's plan. I don't have to go on about that because you already know all that about establishing these professional schools so that there were journalists. And I don't think the world fully appreciates that and what it meant at first to the South and now to the nation.
Talk to me about that.
About pre-professional studies and what Lee did.
Well, what Lee did.
Well, the South was devastated. And his first thought, he wasn't thinking about in those days. It was very different. It was survival. And he felt, he had remarkable vision that there was a need for men who wrote well and who could influence others, journalists, in other words. And you know that he brought there was a little law school in Lexington, of all places. I've never quite understood how that happened, but he incorporated that into the curriculum. And you know, the first journalism courses taught in any undergraduate institution in the country were at Washington and Lee because of with Washington College at that time, because of that. The law is the same. Engineering. I mean, he these professions. When he saw such a need out there after the Civil War, and that's what he thought his mission was to produce these leaders. And then medicine. All these things grew. The only program I think that he did not implement during his time was agriculture. I think he envisioned some sort of agricultural program.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's pretty remarkable. And people just can't believe. And business. The first business courses. I love to tell my prosperous friends who think they're such hot shots from the important business schools that the first business courses the undergraduate level were taught at W&L. I just can't believe that. Not that little place, that little college there in Virginia, but it's a powerful thing when you think about it.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It is. You're the first person to talk about that. I've
really
done the research, and I know what you're talking
yeah.
about, but you're the first person to talk about
oh,
that.
Oh, I just take such pride. We were a classical academy until then. And of course, science was taught, which gave us the base for all that's happened since then. But I don't think people realize how what leadership early on, Washington and Lee, was out there doing pre-professional education. And the result has been the distinguished people that we all know about.
And
it continues.
And Lee made a lot of changes socially, too. He brought the speaking tradition.
Oh, yeah.
And
civility.
The honor system.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Civility and all the things. I think older alumni, and time is passing, so that those who lamented the passing of the speaking tradition are few and far between these days. And our students today would find it sort of, I'm sure, quaint that there was such strong feeling about that. But there was very strong feeling after the war when all of a sudden everybody didn't wear a coat and tie. And that was just, there were many alumni who felt that was an honor offense. That kind of thing was just unimaginable. If you were a gentleman, which all, of course, Washington and Lee men were, they, of course, wore a coat and tie, and they spoke to everybody. whom they passed. And then, of course, the McCormick, isn't the McCormick legend, that's how come McCormick became interested in us. He was spoken to by a student. Mm,
Doremus.
Was it Doremus?
Doremus. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was close. Doremus.
They were within spitting distance of each other.
Jim. But at any rate, that was such a strong tradition that alumni just couldn't believe that we could possibly exist and still turn out gentlemen if we didn't dress properly. If they, not I. God knows, not I, woman.
But, well, now I want to pursue that little clearing of the throat there for a minute. And I think this will probably take us back to how we started back in your student days, yeah. In your dating days. Were they all gentlemen?
Well, let's put it this way. I thought they were, even the wildest part of wild in our day was not all that wild. But I thought there were far more gentlemanly at Washington and Lee than at that other university across the mountain in Charlottesville. Now, it may have had something to do, do you think, with the fact that I was very interested in somebody at WM. But your question was, were they not gentlemen?
Or were they gentlemen?
Yeah. I think
you cleared your throat.
Well, I think I meant that as, well, you know, that there were plenty of times, I go back to the times when discipline problems were settled and settled fast on Monday morning in the dean's office with the faculty member who had gotten the call, let's say, in the middle of the night by from the a friend in the community saying, Dr. Bean, for example, was history and very straight, handsome, distinguished man who took no foolishness. And Dr. Dickey, who taught math, they would be in Frank Gillum's office Monday morning at 9 o'clock reporting that the Betas or the whoever had partied all night and had disturbed Miss so-and-so, who had called and said, Gleason, Mr. Doctor, you must do something about the Betas, or maybe even the local law enforcement. But it was settled, and it was settled by that afternoon, and they were, the IFC, the Interfraternity Council, I don't know what it's called now, was told to do something about it, and usually by their Monday night meeting, it was done. And that, students knew what to expect. They knew it would be settled. So there were a lot of changes in that sort after, over the years, you know, students were less, and we had no house mothers, you know, all that fraternity deal was quite different, fraternity life. But the presence of house mothers made a big difference in those years from a girl's point of view when you were there dating. There was just a certain decorum.
Tell me about that. What kind of decorum?
Well, for example, my mother-in-law, Jim's mother, was just found it hard to believe when she would come to whatever. We didn't have parents. I don't think there was parents today, but in those days, come to graduation. And that the house mothers were expected to put on a lovely party for the parents and the young ladies who were there dating, and they had nothing to work with, so she gave the Delts, I remember, a beautiful silver punch bowl and silver candlesticks because she thought that was the proper way to do things, and she just couldn't believe, we used to die laughing about it, but of course she was right, she just couldn't believe that some of the boys from the South whose parents, whose fathers owned big mills and sort of didn't supply towels or sheets or things that made for nice, gracious living. Well, I don't think there were many like that, but I'm certainly not these days. I just don't worry about it. But you understand that I'm just saying it was a way of life, and she just thought that if Miss, I think her name, Miss, oh, what was her name, Miss Brownlee is what I want to say, they're quite right, the Delt House. He was a charming army widow, just a lovely person, and how could she possibly function if she didn't have the tools, such as a silver punch bowl? And I might add that disappeared.
Oh. Mm.
And I didn't feel free to go and, as I should have, and put my foot down and tell those boys, who after all were only boys, that I would keep it from them. And whenever they wanted it, it would be in, you know, in my attic or whatever. Mm-hmm. So.
I wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I did retrieve the candlesticks. I just felt that at that time in the 70s, nobody was entertaining with silver candlesticks.
So it was in the 70s that the punch bowl disappeared?
I assume it was 70s.
Uh-huh.
When there was, you know.
So it lasted quite a long time.
A lot of going and coming. Yes, and the boys were very proud of it. The house managers, and I liked that. You know, that they're not without, they know the nice way to do things. But there were years there when things were pretty loose. I would say that it was in the late 70s. I think the last time I saw it was I borrowed it to use it Jimmy and Kitty's wedding, as a matter of fact. Took it to a party we were going to have. And then very conscientiously returned it to the Delt House. I have since regretted I did that. But anyway, it was there. She had given it to me. So it was, how did we get to talking about the gentlemanly? I think it was the breakdown kind of came when the 60s and 70s, when things changed everywhere.
How does it manifest itself at Washington and Lee?
When the Cambodian issue and Nixon and all that? Well, my clearest memory of it is driving one morning. At that time, I was working at the BMI library, and I dropped Jim off at his office at W&L and went on down by the president's house down Washington Street and to both. I think maybe he hadn't gotten out of the car. At any rate, we were both stunned to see a mass meeting and students marching in front of Lee Chapel. And it went, it was the time during that crisis where students were, felt so strongly about it. I mean, there was total disruption, classes and all that. And I remember, though, going over to the campus and sitting out there on the front campus and hearing Bob Huntley, who was then president, address the students. And we, both Jim and I, were so proud of him that he took the stand and, of course, the board behind him. That Washington Lee was not going to close down. And that they would be required to go to class. You know, students were leaving. It's even fuzzy in my mind now. They were leaving. They didn't want to go to class. They were all going to go do something to express their frustration with the government and the things that had happened, Kent State and the Cambodian bombings and all of that. And I do remember Jim getting a call from a parent whose name, I've forgotten now who it was, and he was saying, "Dean Farrell, I want you to call John," or whatever his son's name, "in there, in your office, and I want you to tell him that he is," I've forgotten now his phrase. He said, "He's lost his mind if he thinks I'm going to pay for him to leave." Something to the effect that he could leave if he wanted to. He could resign from Washington and leave if he wanted to, and I would have him committed to the insane asylum. I mean, there was such a surge of feelings. Parents calling, "What's going to happen if my son leaves? Will he fail? You know, will he flunk?" And those who have better memories about the academic situation than I will recall how we handled it. I think they had to have a certain grade, or they had to take the exam. They would have to come back. I think it was decided that if a boy was so disturbed about the situation, he felt he had to leave school to go do whatever, he got an incomplete, and he would have to take the exam in order to pass. There was no freebies. And it was pretty, and Bob was very calm about it all. I remember we were terribly concerned about what, there was so much UVA, and there was damage going on. Students are really on the rampage, and I remember that many things of value were stored then in the ROTC building down there on the lower level, and the whole collection of porcelain, the Reeves collection, was down there. And students themselves volunteered to guard that building to keep, because there was a lot of feeling that they were outside, and no doubt about it, agitators from coming over from Charlottesville or other places, wherever, were stirring up a lot. And because we were, you know, a little off the beaten track, but concerned that, that there would be major damage. And somehow we got through that. I think there were sane, quiet heads prevailed, and the faculty and Bob Huntley in the leadership role assuring students and families that Washington Lee was not closing down, and they would meet their, be expected to meet their obligations as students. And it was very reassuring to families. And we were all very proud of Governor at that time. Has anyone talked to you about the speaking? I'm reminded of a time when we weren't so proud, when the board decided that Martin Luther King would not be allowed to speak.
Please talk about that.
And the invitation was withdrawn. It's hard to imagine these days. It just was a sad time, in our view. Jim felt very strongly about that.
Was the faculty and administration?
Oh, the faculty thought it was awful.
Tell me.
To withdraw that. Well, we had a very conservative board, extremely conservative. Now, when I say that, I understand that these were men who were committed to their college, their university, and felt strongly, I'm sure, that they were doing the right thing, but they were from certain states and background. It just, this whole integration thing was just an anathema. They were just dead set opposed. And it depended on how you, well, on your vantage point, I guess. It was the law of the land, and the fact that we were private didn't mean we could ignore that forever. Our peer institutions, you know, Davidson, well, that was a co-educator, they co-educated 10 years before we did it, and I've forgotten now the years there in the 50s, when in the early 60s, when we were, Fred Cole was president, trying so hard to do the right thing, struggling with a board who just would not hear of black students. My husband was dean of admissions. Anyway, it was finally decided that, I wish I had all of the documentation in front of me, and I don't, because Jim has done, somewhere we'll find it. It's either, I've put it, all my materials of that sort away, nothing was lost. Maybe on file in John Elrod's office, because he was very interested in the fact that Jim had done this. But the time came when we were to accept black students. And I was always have taken great pride in the fact that no black student was ever accepted under any kind of formula at Washington and Lee. It was never, we're going to have X percent in next year's class of black students. We just didn't do that. It was so personal. It was only the same policy, rule was applied. Could, in these days we're talking boys, could the boy be a success? There was no remedial work. could he succeed? And that was the way it was. And of course we had, I mean, if you look back at the numbers, I want to say to you, and if I only had it to, I'd need the support, and I'll get it for you at some point. There was no attrition. They all graduated in that early class. At first, this would have been probably about the class, well, I've forgotten now.
The first two came in 1968.
Yeah, I was going to say about the class of 74, 72, along in there.
Mm-hmm.
And their records since then are perfectly just wonderful.
Tell me about that process. Tell me
well,
what
I can
went
tell
on.
Jim would go out to recruit, and I remember his recruiting high schools in Philadelphia, and they were locked. That happens to be one, I remember him coming back and telling me, you go to those schools, it was tough, and the schools were locked, and feeling was very high. Imagine going to, for example, to Charleston, South Carolina, where we have very distinguished alumni, and the private school there always sent Washington Lee such fine boys. And he would be recruiting and talking to those boys and then literally going across town to the black high school to talk to those. And, you know, the feeling among the alumni and people, I mean, it was a time of a lot of passion and concern. This was a whole new thing. But it was happening. And it just happened that Jim was hardly an agitator, hardly a, what would you call it, agitator keeps coming to mind. By that I mean pushing integration for the sake of integration, but he believed in his heart it was the right thing for Washington and Lee to do. And the argument that General Lee would oppose this, we just never felt that was the case. I mean, who knows? But he was a man of vision. And he was, it's been a long time since I've read Byrd's book of the later years. But I think in there, as I remember it, there was reason to feel that he would have known that this was the thing to do. And that the future was going to require black leadership, and who could do it better than we? So he did it, and he did it so well. He had a great gift that I felt some of the others, people who were concerned about the problem, didn't really understand. He had no self-consciousness at all in talking to or in his ongoing relationships with black students. He never thought of it that way.
Jim.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think he succeeded in bringing boys, black students to Washington Lee who did succeed because he had a God-given ability to communicate with young people, and it didn't matter who they were, whatever their background. He had that gift. And I think nothing was a greater source of pride to him than their success, ongoing success. And you've interviewed a number of them, and you know even more than I know, just how successful many of them are. And they, of course, have strong feelings about WML, both ways. It was tough for them, very tough. At the same time, I think they're very proud of their accomplishment, and it is their university, just as much as it is anybody else's. And I think that now being realized, and now we have second generation students. Before you know it, we'll have third generation. You know, that is just thrilling. It just thrilled him that they got through their years, of those tough years of being minorities in a very affluent climate, and cared enough now to send their own children.
Tell me about why it was tough.
Well, socially, for example, why? What social life could a young black man possibly find in Lexington? It was nothing. And there were some who were aware of that and, for example, made it possible for them to have transportation down to Hollins. There were a few black students at Hollins. I think we were all caught up at that time in the feeling that much could be achieved by being educated together, black students and a white, you know, the integration process. And we didn't want, Bob Huntley, for example, did not want the blacks to have their own meeting place. They wanted a black headquarters. They weren't fraternities, for fraternity men. And that was resisted, not to deprive them of anything, but just, I think, driven by the idea that to achieve integration successfully, that was not the way to do it. But in retrospect, I think all of us would agree that that was wrong thinking. If you are one of a handful and you had no one, no place to go, you know, to talk to you, it's just human nature. Jim and I learned firsthand when our son was an exchange student at Chung Chi. This would have been his junior year at W&L, and he was class of 76, so, you know, that academic year. He learned what it was like to be tall and very blonde and blue-eyed, very fair, in a world of Chinese students. And he stood out like a sore thumb. And he traveled all through Asia on his, when the school term ended. We died laughing because he used to tell us he was known as the Bill Walton of Chung Chi, the basketball player, because all of them were much smaller physically than he. And he learned in a hurry what it was like to see very few of your own kind. And to get a sense of what it was like to be a minority. You know, we had no conception of that. Arnold Toynbee, during his years of lecturing at Washington, really a spring term, when the Encyclopedia Britannica underwrote his presence, he had been a collaborator, a colleague of Dee Myers, who taught philosophy. And Dee had formed a friendship with him when he did an index, I think. He helped with the study of history, the multi-volume history that Toynbee was known for in those days. And Dee had known him in England or somewhere. Anyway, they had formed a professional relationship and a close friendship. So he came to W&L and he gave a lecture, a public lecture, every Friday. And the Encyclopedia Britannica underwrote the expense and taped and published his lectures. But he's talked to American artists. This would have been in the late 50s. And we were still fresh from having won the war, and we were, you know, we were the top of the heap. And he reminded American audiences, not just the W&L audiences, but everywhere he spoke, the State Department, I was with him, and remember the shock on some of the faces when he said, you know, the UN is not a private club, and we, white, Caucasians, whatever, are in the minority. That is, they are far more Chinese than they are. And it was a whole brand new thought to us.
Need to turn the tape over.